You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 13th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily. We're live here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson. And coming up in today's programme, China's most prominent political prisoner, Liu Xiaobo, has died aged 61. We'll examine his legacy and ask why Beijing ignored international calls for his release. Also ahead...
In the long run, it's better that the world understands that this doesn't get conflated into Saudi is a big funder of terrorism, which I do not think they are. I've never seen any evidence to suggest they are.
The former British ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Sir William Patey, clarifies his views on Saudi Arabia's indirect funding of terrorism. We'll also head to Toronto for a profile of Canada's new astronaut Governor General. And then...
Behind the shop's vast counter, young men are serving up bouza, or Arabic ice cream, which has an elastic, stretchy consistency, almost like melted cheese.
We sample a local delicacy during a trip to the Palestinian city of Ramallah. All that, plus does having a PhD make you a better military leader? We'll have a whale of a time at the new exhibit at London's Natural History Museum, and we flick through today's Asian front pages. That's all ahead on the Monocle Daily, live on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. So a quick look at the day's top stories. The Chinese Nobel Peace Prize laureate Liu Xiaobo has died aged 61. One of the country's most prominent dissidents, he was denied permission to leave the country for treatment for late-stage liver cancer. President Donald Trump has indicated he could shift his opposition to the Paris Climate Agreement. The president withdrew the US from the 2015 agreement last month. Speaking alongside the French president, Emmanuel Macron, in Paris, he said something could happen with respect to the accord, but he didn't elaborate. The UK has published legislation to sever political, financial and legal ties with the European Union. The repeal bill marks an important step towards Brexit. Opposition political parties say they'll challenge it every step of the way. And France and Germany have set out plans to make fighter jets together and tighten Eurozone cooperation. The move follows a joint meeting of their cabinet ministers in Paris. It's the first since this year's French presidential and parliamentary elections. Those are your headlines. Welcome to Studio One. This is Emma Nelson and you're listening to the Monocle Daily. It's just coming up to 22:03 here in London. China's most prominent political prisoner, the Nobel Peace Laureate Liu Xiaobo, has died of cancer at the age of 61. Supporters around the world have praised his struggle for democratic reform. To the very last, however, the Chinese government ignored international calls for his release so he could spend his final days in freedom. Well, joining me now in the studio is Enzhe Han. He's senior lecturer at the Department of Politics and International Studies at SOAS here in London. Welcome to the programme, Enzhe. We've had a lot... told us about Liu's final days, but can you explain to us how he got to become the political dissident that the whole world got to know about?
Well, I mean, he was first active during Tiananmen student movement in 1989. At the time, he was part of the intellectuals, basically from Beijing Normal University, that engaged with students, and in the end, he was in prison for almost two years at a time. And later, he stayed in Beijing and basically carried out a series of activities that, for example, promote basically more human rights and democracy in the country. He was actually in prison for another twice, and then, so basically the final one was in 2008 and 2009, and that's when he was arrested for asking people to sign this Charter 08. Basically, it was a document that calling for more constitutional reform in China.
Indeed, I mean, this, as you say, was a life mostly spent behind bars following Tiananmen Square. Nonetheless, his fame spread around the world, didn't it?
Well, I mean, I think people genuinely got to know him after the Nobel Peace Prize, basically, being awarded to him. Because previously, there are many, how to say, prominent dissidents. And frankly, many of those dissidents often spend their time abroad. Now, Liu Xiaobo is different from many such figure, predominantly because he refused to leave China. And actually, before the 1989 student movement, he was actually in the U.S. And when he saw students were on Tiananmen Square, and actually he went back to China. And then, and I think that was his conviction, basically, that following, like, by looking at many of such dissidents when they went abroad, often they lost their profile.
They lose their fire, don't they?
Exactly. And then, so... So basically, I think it was his decision to stay in China. And I think even at a time when he was imprisoned for the last time, there were lots of interest in China's government tried to set him in exile. But I think he refused to do so. He decided to stay in China in prison. And I think that was kind of the courage, essentially, that set him apart from many other let's say people who are promoting for democracy, human rights in China, and then that was probably the reason why he was awarded the Peace Nobel Prize.
And if we fast forward to the final few weeks of his life, it's only about, what, 3 or 4 weeks since it was announced that he was being released, and then it suddenly emerged, but it was because he had terminal liver cancer. And then they then ensued this battle between what his release actually constituted. It effectively was him being sent to the first hospital of China Medical University. He was basically sent to hospital to die. He wasn't sent home. And the circumstances of his death were kept a secret as well. Even his family had difficulty dealing with it. It's at this point that the rest of the world suddenly sat up and thought, China's reputation on human rights is still a big, big issue.
Well, I mean, how should I put it that way? I mean, I think... the situation, human rights situation in China never has been good, right? I mean, this is not something that suddenly people realize, oh, wow, the human rights situation is so bad. But the thing is actually, it has always been bad. And then what has changed, I would say, in contemporary relations between China and the rest of the world, essentially, is the leverage that the West has on China has significantly diminished, right? So think about in the mid-1990s, when the U.S. conditioned its most favored nation's status on trade with China's human rights situation, right? So at the time, basically, that there is this kind of, like, I guess, this sort of stick and carrots kind of incentive there, basically try to conform, try to pressure China to conform such international demands on its human rights situation. But today, I guess the strength of the Chinese economy over, and the size of it, essentially means that most Western countries, how should I say, has lost its let's say previous let's say predominance in its ability to influence Chinese government. And in fact, think about the Liu Xiaobo's case. Basically, Norway was significantly penalized for the award, right? I mean, you know, China sanctioned Norway's trade and put on hold its diplomatic relations with Norway for 5 or 6 years. So, and the thing is, nobody came to the rescue of Norway, right? I mean, nobody came out to support Norway, right? I mean, Norway was essentially isolated and did not really have much, didn't have any other sort of countries in Europe or in North America came out to the defense of Norway, right? So, and situations like this, and basically presidents like this, indicates, on the one hand, the Chinese are increasingly become more vindictive of anything that might not be their interest, and they are in the position to retaliate economically. And I think this is not something many countries in the West want to see. I mean, think about Britain, UK, increasingly, especially in a possible scenarios of Brexit, post-Brexit, and in China's market is one of the things that UK is interested of building further. So in such a situation, I don't see clearly that this sort of Liu Xiaobo situation or the case of Liu Xiaobo is going to change much.
I mean, you mentioned that given the fact that you don't have any great hope for change, but people have been rushing today to talk about the situation and to call on China to address its human rights issues a little bit more, or much more severely. Rex Tillerson, the US Secretary of State, has called on China to release Liu Xiaobo's wife and let her leave China. The Nobel Prize Committee have said that Liu Xiaobo will remain a powerful symbol for all who fight for freedom and democracy in a better world, having to place the 2010 Peace Prize on an empty chair in order to honour him. They sound like very strong and empty, but they sound rather empty words. What can the international community do to ensure that human rights become a more central part of any dealings that, that people have with China?
Well, I don't think that is is in the center part of the dealing with China. I mean, much of it, much of it actually perhaps are just lip service sometimes. And people have to say that because of they are pressured by domestic groups and human rights organizations. But ultimately, perhaps with the exception of the US, and US is different. You know, there are different kind of interests involved. Basically, congressional pressure can be quite significant in the US case. But in other European countries, I just don't think that is the case anymore. It's just not in the interest of European governments also in some ways, I mean, it's only the US is powerful enough really to, pose China, at the nose, but I don't think Europe is in such a position.
Enzé Han, thank you for joining us. You're listening to Monocle 24. The British government came under fire yesterday for failing to publish a full report into the funding of terrorism in the UK. Critics said the report appeared to bury criticism of Saudi Arabia. Well, today the former British ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Sir William Patey, was quoted that the country was indirectly funding terrorism. Earlier, Sir William joined Monocle's features editor, Chris Lord, in this studio to explain what he meant.
I was dealing with the accusation that Saudi Arabia is a bigger funder of terrorism as they accuse Qatar of being. And I was trying to make a distinction between funding mosques overseas that may adopt the Salafist Wahhabi version of Islam that is common in Saudi Arabia. And in doing so, they have, in some cases, inadvertently provided a base plate for certain extremists who've either taken over mosques or who have adopted the Salafist ideology and then have gone on to become extremists and terrorism. Saudi Arabia has no intention of actually funding terrorism, doesn't want to, and even wouldn't see itself as funding extremism. But I think the reality is that inadvertently, there are unintended consequences of allowing a particular religious ideology that may fit Saudi Arabia, but when transposed to multicultural, multi-religious, pluralist societies, has a different effect.
So when we hear this refrain that says Saudi Arabia is funding terrorism in the UK, is funding extremism in the UK, when we hear these refrains, is it actually a case of the language is incorrect here? When people use that, when they say that, actually what's happening here is it's a version of Islam that's being exported rather than necessarily funding terrorism.
I mean, I think it's completely wrong to say they're funding terrorism. I think quite the contrary. When I was in Saudi Arabia, they were at great pains to help us eliminate terrorism and to work with the United Kingdom against even extremists, but certainly against terrorists. I mean, what it is they've been funding is that they've been proselytizing, and even they fund mosques, and they don't necessarily direct those mosques. But the ideology, the religious ideology that some of those mosques have adopted because they've had Saudi funding, and is a version of Islam that has produced a degree of intolerance in pluralistic societies that has produced extremism. And from some of those mosques have come some of our worst extremists, the Al-Mahajirun, the Hizb al-Tahrir, the Omar Bakri Muhammad. They all came out of mosques, some of which had received Saudi funding.
Now, I think a lot of people would think, what's in it for Saudi to export its ideology? You know, we talk about Wahhabism, which is the extremely strict form of Islam. It's very, very, in many ways, fundamentalist. It comes back to some of its origins or tries to reinterpret its origins. And it is what's practiced in Saudi Arabia. Why would they want to export that all over the world?
Well, Saudi Arabia covets its position as the centre of the Islamic world. The King of Saudi Arabia is also known as the custodian of the two holy mosques. The two holiest places in Islam are in Saudi Arabia. Every year, hundreds of millions of billions of pilgrims come to Saudi Arabia. So it has a special role in the world of Islam. So it sees itself as an Islamic leader. What has happened is that when we saw revolutionary Iran emerge in 1979, in the 80s and 90s, the Saudis felt a need to counter this revolutionary Shia ideology. So it's a kind of anti-Iranian, anti-Shia counter to the Shia. It also is because that the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia supports the government, and so they're given a certain license to spread their version of Islam. I don't think they ever thought for one minute they were spreading terrorism.
Now, the British government has come under fire recently for failing to publish this full report into the funding of extremism here in the UK. And critics have said that this report seems to bury criticism of Saudi Arabia if it's not published. Is that plausible, do you think?
The word bury is always used when you don't publish. There are lots of reasons why you don't publish. It's not actually burying it. I've not read the report, so I don't know. It may include intelligence about funding of mosques, because it's not a very transparent process. So there may be source reasons. Maybe it's always assumed that if you don't publish, it's because you don't want embarrassment. I think it's possible to have a grown-up dialogue with Saudi Arabia about this. I think there are people in Saudi Arabia who share our concerns about extremism and about terrorism and the growth of terrorism, because it threatens Saudi Arabia. Let's be clear, this is an existential threat to Saudi Arabia. So I think it's possible to have a grown-up dialogue with Saudi Arabia to say, look, this may work in Saudi Arabia, but we'd much rather you didn't fund mosques. We'd much rather you didn't send literature to madrasas in Britain, because it doesn't work here.
You've got a long experience of working with Saudis and in diplomatic posts there in Saudi Arabia. Would they listen to a call like that, do you think?
They'll be defensive, because they hear these calls that says Saudi funds extremism, Saudi funds terrorism. So they'll be sensitive to it. In the long run, it's better that the world understands that this doesn't get conflated into Saudi is a big funder of terrorism, which I do not think they are. And I've never seen any evidence to suggest they are. Not everybody would be receptive, but there would be people in the government who are receptive to the idea that Britain is a multicultural, pluralistic society. And I know from my time, King Abdullah used to say this. He said, what worked in Saudi Arabia is not necessarily appropriate for Muslims in Britain. And he used to say the duty of every Muslim in Britain is to be loyal to their government and to their system. So he knew there was a difference.
And I just want to pull back a little bit from Saudi as well, and just coming back to that Guardian article that we mentioned earlier, you were quoted in there saying that the blockade, which we see from the Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and of course Egypt, have imposed against Qatar, ostensibly because of, you know, what they call Qatar's support of terrorist groups. You said that it has all the hallmarks of a policy that has not been thought through. And I just wondered why you said that, what you meant by that.
Well, it was an answer to a question which was meant to be on background and off the record. But it was an answer to a question of what did I think, given all the adverse consequences, what was the strategy? And I basically said, well, look, I think the four Arab powers were in a hurry to do something that would take a long time. I mean, this is not a new problem. They have been concerned about Qatar's support for the Muslim Brotherhood, for groups which seek, in their view, to undermine their own system, undermine the monarchical system. So this is a long process, and they were looking for a shortcut, I think, is my interpretation. They hadn't quite thought through the consequences. They'd taken Donald Trump at his word, but hadn't quite looked at the overall American interests in the region, the fact that there's a military base in Qatar, and the idea that they might push Qatar further into the arms of Iran, and they might end up with a breakup of the GCC. These are things that don't seem to have been taken into consideration in preparing this. It seems to be almost a decision that was taken over a short period of time, even though the problem has been a long-running one for over 20 years.
You know the Saudis very well. You know how they operate diplomatically and in the region, how they make their presence felt. How far do you think they're willing to go with this blockade?
The Qataris call it a blockade. I think it's a boycott. A blockade's when you surround a country and don't let anything in. But, you know, let's not get hung up on definitions. But I think the Saudis and the Emiratis are prepared to play this long. I think they do have a fundamental difference with Qatar over the future of the Middle East. I think they would see it as a battle over monarchies versus political Islam, stability over chaos, economic progress over more Islam? And I think these are big questions on the future of the Middle East over the next 20 years. So I think they think that Qatar is working against their interests, against the security and stability interests, and they're not prepared to let it go, I don't think.
Do you think that this government is doing enough and this country is doing enough to hold Saudis to account and the sort of export of Saudi ideology to this country? Do you think they're doing enough to hold them to account in the way we were talking about before, about making sure that the right message is coming here and that this message doesn't become a message of extremism and violence?
Well, I think this has been more historical. I think in recent years we've not seen as much as we did. I think in the 80s and 90s there was a lot of Saudi funding of mosques, and there is some, but it's a lot less now. I do think it's possible to have a dialogue. I mean, things like holding them to account and public criticism never really has much impact in Saudi Arabia, in my view. It tends to harden positions. So I think there's quite a lot of quiet diplomacy that can go on with the Saudis explaining. We could even introduce rules that prevent foreign funding of mosques. Some countries have done that. We could do that.
And why do we think we don't do that, Sir William?
I don't think we've thought it was much of a problem until now.
That was the former British ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Sir William Patey, speaking to Monocle's features editor, Chris Lord. You're listening to Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
There's something about Tokyo. Once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting. It's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. Most months, actually, most weeks, there's something new to keep us interested. You know, either it's a new development or a, you know, really interesting new building, a new fashion brand, something going on.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
'23-'22 in Paris, '22-'22 here in London. Have a listen to this.
As a 12th generation Canadian, I'm exactly just that, a Canadian. And I am here to serve all Canadians of all backgrounds, of all walks of life, either new or not so new. So it will be my pleasure, and I will be very open to what I think is our core value in this country: tolerance, openness, and working together.
That was Julie Payet accepting a nomination from the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to be the country's next Governor General. She says she is just a Canadian. Well, she's a little more than that. She's got 18 honorary doctorates. She's a polyglot. She's a mother of two. And she also happens to have been an astronaut as well. We're joining us now live from Toronto is Monocle's bureau chief, Thomas Lewis. It's not a bad curriculum vitae for a Governor General, is it?
It's not a bad one at all, in fact, and I think it's a curriculum vitae that has brought a smile to the face of many Canadians across the country and across political spectrums too. This was broken by CBC News yesterday, ahead of today's announcement by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and I think there was a very sort of warm sense of surprise, actually, that Julie Payette was going to be named as the next Governor General of Canada. Now, the Governor General is the Queen's representative in Canada, is the ceremonial head of state, if you like. She will become effectively the head of the armed forces as well, and will be, you know, Canada's face on the international stage, welcoming foreign dignitaries from overseas, but also travelling around the world, representing Canada too. And I think in that, this decision is really quite an interesting one, actually, that for a ceremonial role, largely, I should say, that to have someone that is so accomplished in a specific field, such as Julie Payette, so obviously is, really does kind of set something of a tone, I think, of the kind of Canada that maybe Justin Trudeau's government wants to assert, even if, you know, the very real sort of day-to-day sort of power of government, if you like, won't be in Julie Payette's hands. But I think to have a very accomplished astronaut and engineer, as you say, she's a polyglot, she speaks six languages, you know, representing Canada around the world as a place of inclusivity, as a place whose doors are open to those who want to come from elsewhere and live here, I think it's really been very warmly welcomed by many people here in Canada.
Indeed, I think we can add to that list the fact that Madame Payette is an athlete, pianist and choral singer as well. I mean, clearly she's got quite a busy diary, and one wonders how she's actually going to have time to be Governor General. She'll obviously be able to fit it in. She's the kind of girl who you get the impression that she'll be able to. But tell us a little bit more about this crest of a wave that the Canadian soft power seems to be riding on at the minute. We've had Canada 150. We have a very good sort of like looking glass to consider over the border in the United States, which will make nothing but good reflections be bestowed on Justin Trudeau. But Canada itself as a country itself is wielding a very positive power at the moment.
I think it is. And I think, you know, all of those things that you've just outlined, Emma, will undoubtedly have played into the considerations of Justin Trudeau and his government when they were looking for a successor for the post of Governor General here in Canada. You know, I think, you know, looking at Justin Trudeau himself, I guess, you know, many would say that, you know, he's the biggest sort of flag bearer for Canada internationally, you know, out there. But I think, you know, domestically, of course, you know, politics is slightly starting to take its toll, I think. And, you know, the rigors of government are raising questions about the Prime Minister and his government's attitudes and approaches to various policy areas. But I think by, you know, having someone like Julie Payette as the Governor General and as Canada's public face in so many arenas is really, you know, this isn't some role that's been given to a political insider for many years. This isn't a role that's now just been given to, you know, someone who's earned their stripes, if you like. You know, this is someone who has achieved very real things and made the country very proud in a very different arena until now. And I think tapping into that is actually pretty clever, I think, because, you know, if you want to look at Canada, if you want to portray Canada as a place of achievement, of where things can happen, of where if you work hard and if you work, you know, with your neighbours, with your colleagues, that, you know, great things can happen. And I think that, you know, Julie Payette, you know, for those who support her at least, will most certainly think that she embodies all of those things. I think it is quite interesting to just note that many people, there were many sort of rumours and hopes, I suppose, here that Justin Trudeau would take this opportunity to appoint the first First Nations Governor General. There had been many names bandied around. It's a particularly interesting time for many First Nations communities here in Canada. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has reported, and many of those recommendations are being worked through by the government. There's also a very high profile inquiry into the disappearance and murder of many Indigenous women over many, many long years, which is one of the most contentious kind of inquiries, I think, understandably, to have been held in Canada for many a long year. And that is undergoing a pretty tumultuous time. We've seen many resignations from the top tier of leadership from that inquiry. So I think many people were looking at, you know, Justin Trudeau has said many times about that this is the time that real reconciliation will happen. And I think for many people felt that actually that clearest symbol of that would have been to have suggested a member of a First Nations community to be Governor General. It is worth noting, however, that many First Nations caucuses of some of the political parties here have warmly welcomed Julie Payette to the Governor General's residence. So it is worth noting that.
Thomas, thank you very much indeed. And from one Canadian astronaut to another, tune into The Globalist at 7 a.m. London time tomorrow morning to hear an interview with Chris Hadfield, the first Canadian to walk in space. You're listening to The Daily. We're live on Monocle 24. Now, military life is an education in itself, but now the United States Marine Corps has announced a plan to give its officers even further schooling. This autumn, two Marines will begin doctoral studies at two universities near Washington, D.C. And the country's elite school of advanced military studies already has 60 officer scholars on their books working towards doctorates. Well, Elizabeth Brewer is a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council. She's written on the topic in the Financial Times, and I am delighted to say that she joins me in the studio. OK, let's talk about the logistics of this. These are two Marine officers. They'll be studying at two universities near to Washington, D.C. People will spot them a mile off, won't they?
Or at least they'll spot their haircuts. Yes, but they won't be wearing uniforms, I think it's safe to say, while mingling with the 25-year-olds at, let's say, Georgetown or George Washington University.
It's just the thought of them wandering around. Yes, not in uniform, but one can generally spot a Marine in so many different ways.
At least in the gym.
It's one of those situations, though, isn't it, that we... It is... So many people have said that in order for one to be a keen military leader, and this goes back millennia, doesn't it, that one has to have a strong intellect as well. One wonders why it's sort of taken the United States military so long to sort of single out the Marines as being particularly good candidates for strong leaders.
Yes, the history is, of course, that's soldiers, armed forces, officers deal with the practicalities of warfare, and or at least in democracies, and then there are civilian leaders who tell them what objective they should work towards. So they essentially arrange the boots on the ground, and the civilian leaders tell them which ground they should be thinking about. And the result of that is that the military is essentially is more operational, and civilian leaders are the civilian leaders are strategic thinkers. But when the world is getting more complex, there is a case to be made, which I think is what the U.S. armed forces have discovered, for the experts who actually deal with the complexities on the ground to also provide the strategic thinking.
The United States is a bit of a trailblazer in terms of a country for this, and they've spent several officers will have spent years in academic training. One need only look at General Petraeus, who has PhDs coming out of his ears, and he is considered to be the foremost thinkers in sort of military strategy. What effect does it have on the rest of the world when it sees that the United States does embrace the intellectual side of military?
A huge effect. And you mentioned Petraeus. I mean, he is a hero to officers and in fact civilian decision makers around the world. And he has a PhD from Princeton, which he earned while a serving officer as part of his career within the armed forces. Same thing with General McMaster, who is now the National Security Advisor, also earned a PhD as part of his military career. He studied at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. So, and then, of course, we have the foremost hero at the moment, General Mattis, James Mattis, who is now Defense Secretary, who doesn't have a PhD but has a huge intellect, and his reading lists are the preferred reading of not just military officers, but a lot of thinkers, not just in the armed forces in the US, but around the world.
An awful lot of care is taken when working with the military. For the military make it very, very clear that they don't like to step out of the national obligations that they fulfil, and they don't like to pass commentary. Now, the likes of General Petraeus, and once you get to the absolute top echelons of leadership, that's somehow sort of like those rules can be bent a little. But if you have a group of deep thinkers inside the military, is there more of a risk that they will question the political motives and decisions made by the political, their paymasters, the people who pull their strings?
Yes, that's a very good point. And in fact, you could argue if the US had a different president from the one it has right now, would it be welcome for General, would General Mattis be, or Secretary Mattis now, be welcome to provide that sort of strategic advice that he's providing now? I mean, it's a good idea right now, I would argue, because President Trump is who he is.
It's a country that needs all the brains it gets.
That's right. But for example, a country like Germany, traditionally since World War II, has not been keen at all on officers providing strategic advice, because it would risk basically getting the country back into the sort of militaristic thinking that hasn't served it well in the past.
Indeed. I mean, are we likely to see, with the growing intellectualization of the United States and the comparative weakness in the administration in the White House, are we likely to see a stronger long-term prospect for the United States military to exert even more power or even more influence over the policymakers?
I think so. Because if you look at the sort of leaders who are likely to take power, they will have had little experience serving in the armed forces themselves, or little experience with conflicts. Whereas if you compare, George H.W. Bush had been a fighter pilot in the war. Donald Rumsfeld was a former officer. So you had that sort of institutional memory in previous leaders, and that's not likely to be there in the future.
So which countries do you think are going to start taking a bit more of a cue from this? I mean, you mentioned Germany, but you've written in your article in the Financial Times that you find it quite surprising that the European armed forces offer such opportunities for high-ranking military officials. I think if you work lower down the ranks, and people on a much lower grade can get some basic qualifications, which actually is an absolutely vital tool for when they leave the military. But does this prepare people who are high ranking for ultimately a role in government of some kind?
Yes, and that's exactly what the Marine Corps wants to achieve. They say in their statement that they want to create a cadre of experts in strategic affairs within the Marine Corps. So it's not the objective is not having better military planners, it's strategic experts. And the Army says the same thing. It says the graduates of the PhD program you mentioned are expected to serve key planning positions at the Pentagon, in the White House, in Congress and the State Department. So that goes far beyond the US Army.
Elizabeth Brough, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. Here in London. Now, who says that Monocle does not care for those suffering in summertime heat? We have a solution to the age-old summertime question. How do you stop an ice cream from melting too quickly? Well, we've had to travel quite a long way to get that answer for you. We went to the Middle East. When temperatures start climbing in the Palestinian city of Ramallah, locals cool off with a special kind of Arabic ice cream. It's made for the hot climate because it has one specific heat-resistant characteristic. It stretches. Monocle contributor Mary Pelletier fought the queues at Rukab's, the oldest Arabic ice cream parlour in Ramallah, to find out their secret.
In the Palestinian city of Ramallah, there's one sweet, sweet sound that signals the arrival of summer. Grab a few shekels and follow that voice. It's the ice cream man, heading into Ramallah's old city. He's wearing a desert cap and has a white cooler swung over his shoulders. It's emblazoned with the bright pink and blue logo of Palestine's premier ice cream proprietor, Rukab's, the same name he shouts all over town. On this sweltering July afternoon, a small child bolts after him, flags him down, and leads him back to his father, who's waiting with his wallet and a wide smile. But for those too slow to catch the roving coolers, back in the center of town, Rukab's ice cream shop is always open, serving up a particularly Arabic style of the summertime treat.
I love ice cream. Everywhere I go, I try other ice creams. And I'm very glad that our ice cream is in good quality.
That's Isan Rukab, the head of the Rukab's ice cream family. It's 10 a.m. on a hot Sunday, and the ice cream parlor is already filling up with customers. Some are buying cones, others small old-fashioned dishes filled with colorful scoops. For 76 years, Rukab's has been serving traditional Arabic ice cream from the premises. So popular is their product that the main road running by the shop is known affectionately as Rukab Street.
My dad, he used to sell the ice cream after school. He used to make it at home because my grandmother taught him how to make it. He started the business 1941 and he started making varieties. At that time, Palestine was under the British mandate. And the certificate of this business, it's written in Hebrew, English, and Arabic.
The political situation in the region may have changed quite a bit over the past 76 years, but Rukab's core recipe remains the same. Behind the shop's vast counter, young men are serving up bouza, or Arabic ice cream, which has an elastic, stretchy consistency, almost like melted cheese. It's a simple recipe, milk and sugar combined with Arabic gum, a sort of sap resin from the mastic tree. The scoops are dense, and the gum helps to keep the ice cream from melting too quickly in the hot Levantine climate.
We use traditional Arabic gum, the mastika. We get it from Greece. It's a product that makes ice cream stretchy, yeah, and tasty at the same time. It helps in the texture of the ice cream, and it provides a bondage, like makes the ice cream as one piece, not bubbles inside or no air inside. In the hot summer days, you feel the chill.
Just over the road from the ice cream parlor and down a small alleyway, Rukab's factory is tucked away from the main street. After a quick coffee, Isan led the way.
Okay, let's go to this way.
Isan's father set up the factory in 1951 to keep up with the ice lolly demand. Today, Rukab's 40 employees churn out thousands of ice lollies, wrapped cones, ice cream sandwiches, and bars every hour. Not to mention the 5-kilogram tubs that are run up to the parlor when certain flavors are running low. Workers with giant ice cream churning spatulas weave between gleaming tanks where the mix of fresh milk, sugar, and Arabic gum is left to set before other ingredients are added.
Do you use Arabic gum as a base for everything?
Yes. These are the old-fashioned machines that makes the ice cream. Vertical batch freezers. Usually they work two flavors at one time. Four of them Arabic gum. Two of them for coconut.
Back at the ice cream parlor, there's an overwhelming number of flavors to choose from. Oreo, mint chocolate chip, Ferrero Rocher, cheesecake, bubblegum. Go with a medium-sized Friska cone for 10 shekels, and you get 3 different scoops of your choice. But according to Isan, the traditional flavors are still their most popular.
Vanilla, the Arabic gum flavor, the mastika flavor, the pistachio, nuts with the mastika, lemon, strawberry, pineapple, and chocolate. These were the main flavors, the old-fashioned flavors. And my son, he was studying in Boston, and he came, he said, why don't we make other varieties like vanilla chocolate chip, a rum raisin, the American style? So we started doing it.
Since suggesting a flavor expansion, Isan's 35-year-old son Jimmy has taken over management of the ice cream parlor and oversees factory production.
It is always busy.
Yeah.
Has the demand always been that high?
It's always been high, and we hope it's growing. Yeah. We really hope it's growing. We've always had hopes of expansion, but we don't want to expand and ruin the quality. We want to expand and keep the same quality. Because, you know, when you start mass producing, it's going to be at the expense of your quality. So we're trying to find a way that if we open in Jordan, Dubai, London, wherever, we serve the same quality we serve here in our store.
As noontime neared, the parlor filled up with families and children, and I gave up my seat to those in need of a cold ice cream. But not before Isan could offer up one last vintage treat.
This is the oldest product at Rukab's. This is glacé. We call it glacé. It's wrapped in aluminum foil. It's chocolate and vanilla. Vanilla dipped in chocolate. It's a bonbon.
Shukran.
For Monocle, in Ramallah, I'm Mary Pelletier.
I think I could listen to that man all day. That was Mary Pelletier in Ramallah. You can hear more on this week's edition of The Menu at Stretchy Ice Cream, completed at 1900 London time. That's 11 a.m. if you're listening in Los Angeles. You're listening to Monocle 24. The Asian newspaper review is just around the corner.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
On Meet the Writers this week, join me, Georgina Godwin, as I talk to Marie Elsa Bragg. She's been a ballet dancer, spent almost a decade in a near comatose state, found a vocation as an Anglican priest, campaigned for women's rights within the church, and she also trained as a therapist. Now she's produced a beautiful novel, Towards Melbrake, a tragic and poetic hymn to the disappearing world and landscape of rural Cumbria. That's Marie Elsa Bragg on Meet the Writers, premiering this Saturday at 1500 London time, and thereafter available as a podcast.
Time in Beijing is 5:45 a.m. 22:45 here if you're listening in London. So I'm now to find out what's making the Asian front pages, and I'm delighted to say John Everard, formerly the UK's ambassador to North Korea, joins me in the studio. And during that little bit of a break, we were discussing bendy ice cream, and you found some bendy ice cream in Afghanistan. We've just been hearing about bendy ice cream in Ramallah.
That's right. For the same reasons, I imagine the Afghan ice cream makers used to blend in bonding agents to the ice cream so that it didn't quite go over you. It went kind of shh instead.
Excellent. John, let's look at the papers. What have we found? Can you do it in sounds tonight? I'd be most grateful.
Well, I thought we'd start with the story of the imminent changes to the US-South Korean Free Trade Agreement. Bit difficult to do that in sounds, at least polite ones. The free trade agreement between the US and South Korea has been in force since March 2012, so it's been around for about 5 years, and has really boosted trade between the two countries enormously. But Donald Trump, when he first came to office, said that he does not like trade agreements in general, and he singled out the South Korean one for particular opprobrium. When President Moon Jae-in of South Korea went to Washington a couple of weeks ago, the two presidents kind of talked about it a little bit, and the South Koreans went away hoping that all that was going to happen was there was going to be a bit of rumbling and nothing much else. No such luck. The US trade representative, Lighthizer, has now formally written to his South Korean counterpart saying that he wants a meeting of the Joint Committee, which is the big body under the Free Trade Agreement, to discuss amending its terms. It's going to be a slow process. There's a laborious system where you have to agree agendas before you even start down to meet to get into the substance. So nothing's going to happen very soon. But clearly South Koreans are alarmed. It took a long time to thrash out the deal, and trying to unpick it even from within the deal is going to be quite untidy.
This starts two separate narratives, doesn't it? We have the American narrative, which is driven by Donald Trump's hatred or dislike of free trade deals. On the other side, we have South Korea desperately trying to not make this into an enormous crisis. And we have one official saying that this does not mean that the two sides will be renegotiating the deal. It does, though, doesn't it?
Not quite. There are degrees of renegotiation. Donald Trump could simply have ripped up the deal, just announced a US withdrawal. He didn't do that. Nor did he seek formal renegotiation. That is to say, we sit down, we start all over again. What he's done is he's got his trade representative to operate within the trade agreement, call a meeting of the Joint Committee, and try to amend terms sort of from within the system. So there were worse things that he could have done and refrained from. Not just two narratives, three. Because, of course, many other countries with free trade agreements with the United States will be watching what happens with great care and some anxiety, notably, of course, Australia.
Indeed. Right, let's move to the Indian Express, an article about Fontgate. What is Fontgate?
Wow, how far back do you want to go? Remember the Panama Papers, the great revelation from Mossack Fonseca, the law firm, 11.5 million files put into the public domain, showing all kinds of complex arrangements by the super rich to shelter their money. Of course, this scandal went off in all directions, but one of the people involved was Nawaz Sharif, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, not directly, but through various legal entities with which he's associated. And the Pakistani authorities decided this had to be flushed out. And with Nawaz Sharif's blessing, it has to be said, set up a joint investigation team to look at whether there was anything untoward in what was coming out of the Panama Papers about the Prime Minister. All kinds of things emerged, but I mean, it's not time to talk about all of them now. But the big story was the sudden emergence of four large and prestigious apartments in central London, actually in Avonfield, which is on Park Lane. If you know London, you'll know that's a very swanky address indeed. And these apartments are worth a great deal of money. Just as a measure of their worth, they've been used as a collateral for $11.8 million worth of loan. The Sharif family has been busily distancing itself from these apartments, though it hasn't quite explained how they suddenly appeared and why they were never declared for tax. The investigation team believed that they actually were down in the name of Mariam Sharif, so Nawaz Sharif's daughter. She denied this, and in support of her denial, she produced in 2000 a document dated in 2006 that showed that she was simply a trustee of these apartments, and that it was her brother Hussein who was the actual beneficial owner. So far, so murky. Then it gets really strange. The investigators sent the document off to various experts who pointed out that the document dated 2006 was actually written in a font that wasn't available until 2007. The Calibri font, now actually quite common, but also fairly new. This, of course, is throwing the cat right among the pigeons. It does look very much as if this was not only a fake, but quite an incompetent fake. And things have been compounded by the fact that if you go to the Wikipedia site on Calibri, somebody has been busily trying to edit the date at which it was introduced to try and make out it was brought out in 2004. So vigorously, in fact, that the Wikipedia editors have said no further edits to this page until after the investigation is over. It would be funny if it wasn't so serious.
Panama Papers, you've got a lot to answer for. Right, finally, we have a minute and a bit to talk about either the Black Widow or funny thumbs and toes. Which one do you want to go for?
Okay, let's go for funny thumbs and toes.
Off you go. Don't look this up on the internet unless you have a very strong stomach.
That's right. And if you do look on the internet, avoid the version with the pictures. Zach Mitchell, we're back to sounds now. A ranch hand in Kimberley in Australia.
Not much of a ranch hand.
Well, a slightly less-handed ranch hand than he was. Got caught up with some heavy cattle, and one of the bulls ripped his thumb off, poor man. So, you know, being a good ranch hand, he and his...
Nearly hand,
yes, branch nine-fingered. A mate of his put the thumb in cold storage, and they went quickly to the nearest hospital, who tried to reattach it and couldn't, told him that a prosthetic thumb wasn't going to work, but said the best thing to do is if we cut off your big toe and stitch it onto your hand, it'll look a bit bigger than a thumb, but really not a bad match. And after some misgivings, you can imagine, Mr. Mitchell decided that was what he was going to do. And he's now the proud possessor of... four fingers, one thumb and one big toe on his hands. And the picture suggests actually it doesn't look quite as bad or quite as gruesome as one at first imagined. The surgeon said, we actually do this about once every 18 months. So there's a lot of thumbed or thumbless people with toes out there.
Everybody walking around in circles. John Everard, thank you so much for joining us in the studio to discuss fonts, toes and goodness knows what. You're listening to Monocle 24. Finally, while we process all that, let's take a trip to London's Natural History Museum to relax. Since 1979, the large skeleton of Diplodocus, imaginatively named Dippy, has commanded pride of place in the museum's main entrance foyer. But tomorrow, Dippy's time in the sun comes to an end because, well, he went some time ago, but he's been replaced by a 25-metre blue whale skeleton called hope. The change was met with some opposition, but the museum says it'll focus visitors' attentions on the living world at this critical moment in history. Well, to find out more, we sent Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco to the museum, and he spoke to Oliver Crinman, who has the great job of being senior curator for fish.
It's a 4-metre-long giant fish, which doesn't normally occur in the UK. This is only the second ever specimen that has turned up here, and it was stranded in Wales. Now, obviously, at the Natural History Museum, we're the go-to place for natural phenomena, and so events like that are reported to us. It was initially reported as a swordfish. Once we got details, we could see that this was actually something rarer, far rarer, and it's a blue marlin, which we would normally find on the other side of the Atlantic in warmer waters. It's an ocean-going predator that follows ocean currents. For this one to have turned up a bit lost, I suspect, in Wales, was an opportunity we couldn't miss. And we've preserved the whole thing in fluid, and people can get up close and have a look at it.
Oh, and we're very close to it, and I can tell you, it's 4 metres. It's much bigger than I would think.
Yes.
I think people will be surprised.
Yes, they will. It's very impressive, isn't it? And to have it in a fluid, the whole body, not just a stuffed specimen, it adds an extra dimension to this impressive marine animal.
One of the things I noticed, especially with the blue whale skeleton, which we can talk a bit later, is that the Natural History Museum wants to show perhaps something more current, perhaps telling people, you know, that natural history is not only dinosaurs in the past, I mean, also, but not the only thing.
Of course, biodiversity and the range of living things in the world is a constantly important question as we consider everything, especially man's impact on the world. And if you look at a warm water fish like the marlin turning up in the UK, it immediately raises questions as to why. And so much of biology is still for us to discover. It's very important for us to record, preserve specimens, and make the information that we get available to the public. So a big new exhibition like this just refreshes exhibits and brings them up to date.
If we could perhaps talk, I mean, we're very near to the main skeleton of the blue whale.
Yes.
I mean, it is, again, very fantastic. I think many people will not miss, what was the name, Dippy? Because it's a nice new challenge. How do you think the public will react to it?
Well, Dippy was popular. It was a cast of a skeleton. It was perhaps time to move to a new thing to look at in the main hall, and look how magnificently it fills the space. A beautifully articulated whole skeleton. A very impressive marine mammal. So I think, again, something that people will enjoy. And Dippy's on tour anyway, so he hasn't disappeared.
Dippy didn't die.
No.
Another thing I would ask, you know, there are also quite a few other specimens here. Can you tell us about some of them?
I don't know so much of them, but I think that what has been intended here is a range of exhibits that point to the other parts of the museum's collection and research. So obviously in the galleries we can only show sort of not exactly token but good representative specimens, and they point to the vast collections that the museum has. So, for instance, the marlin actually is here, if you like, as a representative of the millions of preserved specimens we have in these fluid collections.
How long have you been working for the Natural History Museum?
I've been here 43 years now, so it's something of a vocation.
What a fascinating place to work as well. How do you feel after such a long time? And, you know, with this new exhibit and everything?
I can't complain, can I, with such interesting things to work with. The museum constantly provides a learning environment for all of us who work here, and that's very exciting. It's very rewarding. As a kid, I was a visitor, always a great fan of the museum. To have been able to spend my career actually working with the fishes at the museum has been a real privilege. And this is something of a climax, I must say, to have the first really big fluid preserved fish into the galleries. I've been looking forward to that for a long time.
Oliver Crimmon, Senior Curator for Fish at the Natural History Museum here in London. He was talking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco under the skeleton of Hope, the blue whale. That's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks to our producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan, researchers Yolene Goffin and Hester Underhill. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. The Globalist is here in 8 hours' time. Georgina Godwin will be your host, and the Monocle Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.